welcome to Real Vision Live. For Real Vision, I'm Max Wheatley. I'm joined today by Peter Brandt, who's making his return to Real Vision after I don't know how many appearances now. Peter, if you haven't heard of him, which I can't believe, he's the president and founder of Factor Trading, and he can be found on Twitter at what is your handle these days, Peter?
Peter L. Brandt, at Peter L. Brandt.
Yeah, well, Peter is extremely generous with his thoughts on Twitter, and you can find him there with lots of great charts. We're going to go through about 15 charts today, and I know people will have some questions. So I want to jump right into them, Peter. Let's start with the euro currency.
Yeah, and hey, by the way, it's always great being on Real Vision. I love Real Vision, and it's just you guys have something special, and it's always great for me to be part of it. But we're talking the euro currency. There's a couple things that I see that I just want to point out without necessarily, you know, and maybe I can be lucky enough to sidestep a prediction, but at least kind of point out some things that people should be aware of. I mean, the main thing to me is, you know, we've been up since last March in the euro currency against the dollar. And we are now building into the market the fact that we have historically large commercial short positions. The commercials are short. Now, some of that's hedging, but the big boys, the big companies, the big trading operations, commercials are short, and the euro currencies, speculators are long. Now, that doesn't mean that automatically you come to a bearish conclusion and you just assume that specs eventually are going to be wrong. Commercials are always right because they can hold their position. But basically, it's pretty dangerous to bet against commercials in favor of specs when we have historic extremes and commitments of traders. That's where we are right now. Commercials have loaded up on the short side of the euro currency. You know, despite the fact, you know, during this rally we've had since March. And so that leads me to say, okay, maybe not all is well in euro currency land, that we have to start thinking about the fact that we're going to see some liquidation, we're going to see some squaring of positions that will put downward pressure, especially now that maybe we have interest rates heading back up. The other thing to consider is on the other side of the coin, on the same side of the coin, is the world is always short dollars. I mean, the world financial system always sits in a short dollar position. And so if you see a turn in the dollar back up, because the U.S. dollar is now back testing the, I think it was the February 2018 low. So it's a good point for the U.S. dollar to find support where it is right now. So we have the U.S. dollar back into a very strong area of support on its longer-term charts. We have the euro currency, which has been rallying since March. And in light of that, we have big commercial shorts in the euro currency, historic long positions on the part of the specs. We have historic long positions in the U.S. dollar index by commercials, historic shorts by specs in the U.S. dollar. And so we may be finding the fact that there is an historic tendency for the euro currency to either find a top or a bottom in January, the first 2 weeks of February. I've talked about that almost yearly, in fact. It's been my privilege to talk about what I call the January effect in the euro currency, the tendency to have a major turn or, you know, a major lower, major high in the month of January, first 2 weeks of February. So I'm thinking that's what I kind of want to be geared to right now as a trader. It's way too late, I think, to be short the dollar and long the euro currency. We're late in the game. That's a trade that's worked for 10 months. Time to really start looking for opportunities going the other way. On the euro currency, you know, we could go back to last year's lows. There's a major 50-year trend line that we bounced off of last in March in the euro currency. So we had back there. So that's what I'm thinking in euro currency, just in terms of the charts, when we look at euro currency is, hey, maybe it's time to start scoping out a short position, at least to be aware of it. And so that's kind of where I am as a trader. I'm thinking I want to look for a shorting opportunity in euro currencies, a buying opportunity in the US dollar index.
Okay. So I have here the long-term chart that goes back into the 70s, really actually before the euro existed. So for anybody who's confused to see a 1970s euro, why don't you explain what that is? And then we have that long trend line. And then I want to go through that second euro chart too, just specifically.
Sure. The euro currency hasn't been around 50 years. That's the first thing people say. But what we do here is we have that chart that can go back, because prior to the euro currency, what we do as a proxy is take the trade weighted basket of the European currencies that existed at the time, French franc, Deutsche Mark, Italian lira, and so forth. And we create a proxy that really pre-existed the euro. And therefore, we can create a chart that goes back into the 70s. And that's what we have there. And so that's how we create that chart, Max. And so that's where we get a 50-year trend line.
Okay. And then we have the euro futures, a little bit shorter term chart here. What are you seeing in this chart?
Well, I mean, it's possible to look and say we have a 6-year continuation head and shoulders top. And I think that's the chart you're looking at. Is that we take the price action over the last 6 years and we say, this looks strangely like a head and shoulders top. It could come to be. The question I asked some very, very sharp macro traders today is, how do you get an 80-cent euro currency? Their answer to that is, you have to break up the euro. You have to break it up. I mean, you have to have Italy, or you have to have Spain collapse and pull out of the euro currency. You start doing that, you crumble the euro currency, and that's probably the only way it takes place. And so, might that big 6-year head and shoulders in the euro currency come to pass? Probably not, but you can create a macro scenario where it could.
Okay. And then, so with that in mind, when you think about if somebody does want to, take a short position in the euro, what are the ranges that you could see?
Well, I think we're nearing the top end range now, but for right now, that trend line comes in, $1.05, something like that. But when you go back really over history, the euro currency, even though we had a big move last year, is in really a rather dull, narrow range relative to what has happened over the last 20 years, let's say. And so it's been pretty tame. It's been, to talk about maybe we have 15 cents on the downside of the euro, it seems like a big percentage. But if you look at the euro currency trading, really going back into the 70s and the 80s, well, you'll go back on the proxy back into the 70s. But over the last 20 years, 15 cent range in the euro currency it does not really take it into wild and crazy territory.
Yeah. And then moving on to just this chart of the dollar here, often, they're kind of, when you talk about being long euro, you're short dollar, because the dollar index is made up so much of the euro. But there are other aspects in there. So just to focus specifically on this chart of the dollar.
Yeah. When you look at the chart of the dollar, basically we're back and we're holding that February 2018 low, right around 88.15. Here's my comment. I don't know if I can name somebody who is not bearish the U.S. dollar. My experience as a trader is when you get an idea that has such conventional, it becomes really gospel. You go out, it's really easy to say the dollar is going to dump, the U.S. Fed continues to print money. The U.S. dollar is garbage, the U.S. dollar is worthless, the U.S. dollar goes down, the U.S. dollar is bearish, and so forth. The social media is filled with dollar bears. You cannot find a dollar bull. You can in real vision, you can find, certainly from time to time, Raul has certainly been a dollar bull. At least he likes to drift there. but you know, he's a flexible trader. But generally speaking, when you look out into social media, all you see is the dollar is garbage. And yet you have historic long positions in the dollar index by commercials. You're down in an area of very, very strong historical support. And you basically have the world banking system and world commerce system short dollars in a short dollar position. And so you can create a scenario that if we start to see the daily chart bottoming down in this area, be on the alert. Perhaps, you know, we've got a long trade coming in the dollar. I mean, I'm not long. I'm not short the euro currency. I'm not long the dollar. But that's kind of what I smell as a scent that's coming into the air.
Okay. Well, here's a scent that is definitely in the air, but has not received nearly as much attention as the euro and the dollar, other currencies, or you know, cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin that everybody's talking about now, is the Nikkei. The Nikkei just had a massive breakout that what is that? A 30-year range?
Yeah, a 30-year range. You know, I tell you, everything I look at in terms of financial markets, in terms of stock markets, I can't find a stock market that's not been on this big tear and is either at all-time record highs or close to record highs. You look at what's happened, and we'll talk in a little bit about the S&P's U.S. market, other markets, and it's easy to forget that the Japanese stock market's all-time high was in 1989. That's 31 years ago. You know, we were in a bear market for decades in the Japanese market. You know, you can't find another market that can say it's, you know, its all-time high was 30 years ago, you know, especially a strong economy, a viable economy like Japan. And so we created this massive, what I call a bowl or a base in the Nikkei Dow. We've broken out decisively. I think we run back to that, you know, the all-time highs at least in the Nikkei. So we had back to 39,000, which was the high we made 31 years ago. So, you know, I'm long the Nikkei. I trade the Nikkei through Osaka. So I trade Osaka futures. That's my position. It's one of those. I like that story and I'm sticking with it. I mean, I think we are in a multi-year bull trend, and we have been in a multi-year bull trend, but part of that bull trend was still down in the base. It was still down in the bowl of the chart. And so we blasted off. And so I think we go to at least new all-time highs in the Nikkei, probably go much higher than that. And so I like Japan. I like the Japan indexes. I like individual stocks over in Japan. Sony, Toyota, you can go stock after stock. You can find many, many individual stocks over in Japan that really are now entering bull market territories. So I like Japan. I'm way overweighted in Japan.
Okay, wonderful. Well, the Nikkei has broken out as well. We have Chinese equities as breaking out. So there is some strong bullish trends in Asia. Are you as bullish on China as you are on Japan?
Yeah, China is such an interesting story. For years, I've been saying, you know, you had the 1800s, were the centuries of Western Europe. Then we had 1800s, 1900s, the centuries of North America, that we are entering a century of Asia. And people want to dispute that. People want to argue that. Well, you can argue it all you want, but just look at the facts. You have strong economies over there. You go over to Asian countries, you see modern cities. People want to argue against China and say, oh, you can't trust their numbers, they're corrupt. It's, you know, the whole thing shaky. The reality is, I think, you know, China is going to emerge here and be recognized as the strongest economy in the world. You look at the Chinese, and I trade the China A50. That's the futures contract that I trade. That's traded in Singapore. I like it. I'm long it. I'm overweighted it. I think China's got a long way to go. It's broken out of this massive ascending triangle on the charts, multi-year ascending triangle. The ascending triangle is a powerful pattern. It's really one of the most powerful patterns. And so We're really early. We're early in the bull market in China. Have a long way to go in China. I think the A50 goes, I mean, the first target's 21,000, but I mean, I think we start there. And so I like China. I like the A50. I like the Chinese economy. Sure, their numbers may be corrupt, but I think time will prove that they're well poised, and you can get into the whole politics of Chinese trade and all of that. But I think people who are long China will be well served.
Okay. We did get a question on the Nikkei. Vincent asks, who will buy the Nikkei ETFs if the central bank starts selling? My response would be, what's going to make them start selling?
Yeah, I mean, of course, what you've done is, in effect, federalize the stock market in Japan, right? I mean, it's been their way of kind of monetizing their debt is just to own all of their stocks. And there'll be a point where maybe they have to sell stock markets. You know, you look at the demographics of Japan, and, you know, it's getting older. But I look at the charts and I go, it's not going to happen right now. It's not going to happen in this trade. And, may it happen down the road? Yes. But as a trader, I want to respond. I don't want to get way out in front of myself and look at the strong trend and a reason to be long the market and doubt myself based on conjecture. And the whole idea of Japan's central bank selling that, that's conjecture at this point in time. It's not happening.
Yeah, well, and in a sort of don't fight the Fed way, that it's more of a bull argument than a bear argument. It's that you have
sure
the central, yeah, central bank buying. Well, I want to go to an old favorite of yours. I know it's something you've probably been trading longer than almost anything else, corn. So corn has broken out, and it has been talked about really as evidence that the inflation trend is real and that it's kicking in. So I want to get just a pure chartist view from you on what you're seeing here with corn, but also, are you buying ag commodities as signaling the coming inflation, or is this more, you know, supply disruption that we're seeing work its way out in prices, but short-term stuff?
Yeah, I mean, there's an inflation story to be told, Max. Let me explain to people how I look at it. I started at the Chicago Board of Trade as a corn trader in 1975. You look at the price of just about everything else in the world. Corn right now is priced where it was in 1975, even though we've had a big run up. I traded corn in 1975, 1976 at current prices. That's not adjusted for inflation. And so, relatively speaking, agricultural prices have gone nowhere. They are right where they were in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 2000s. Now, the tendency of raw material markets is you have bull markets and you collapse. Yeah, you know, it's like popcorn. It bounces up to the top of the kettle and then goes right back down to the bottom of the pan. And so you have popcorn markets and the egg markets. But from time to time, you kind of have a whole reevaluation of price structure. You know, in the early 1970s, we had a bull market in agricultural goods, and it took prices to a whole new level from where it was in the 50s and the 60s. That may be happening again. I mean, we've come out of a magnificent rectangle base in corn that I think brings markets up. But the story in agriculture, at least right now, is supply and demand. You know, it's supply pressures coming out of South America. It's demand pressures coming out of Asia. It's not really an inflationary story. It could become an inflationary story. But right now, it's a pure supply and demand fundamental story. That what happens in the grain markets is you renew your fundamentals. Your fundamentals change in effect every year because you put new crop in the ground, you have a new crop, you have a whole new set of supply and demand statistics that you look at. But we're in a crop year that does not end for another 10 months. And we have 10 months to get through. And the pricing mechanism of grains is to assure that there is crop left in the pipeline, that we don't run out of grain, that there's enough grain to fill the pipeline to keep elevators at least somewhat full, to keep supply going to users, to keep supply going to hog farmers, cattle farmers, into the export channels. And price performs that mechanism. Price will, in effect, be the governor that we do not run out of grains. That's what's happening in the corn market. At what price does that happen? I don't know. But we don't even have a corn crop in the ground right now. Well, what happens if we have weather problems this year? I mean, there is a whole lot that can happen between now and the time that we bring another corn crop in out of the field in October, November. And so, yeah, I look at that and say, buy the dips, buy the big dips. Could we become an inflation story in raw materials down the road and take all grains to a whole new level and create a whole new price zone for grains down the way? That could happen. But for right now, it's a bull market. It's based on fundamentals. We have a lot of crop year left. We have a lot of weather to get through. We haven't even put a corn crop in the ground. The dips have to be bought. The grain prices are down today. Beans have been down close to 30 cents. Corn's breaking. But you buy 30-cent breaks in corn.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's really interesting what you're saying about how it could become inflation. So it's that reevaluation that could come from just a hard year that might push the industry and really the market in general to rethink where, you know, the investment that's being put into ags at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you look at the price of equities relative to real things. Whether it be copper, gold, crude. Hey, look at crude oil. Maybe we'll talk about crude oil.
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
You look at the price of raw materials versus equities, it's way out of whack. As an asset, stock prices, you just can hardly justify where they're at relative to the real things in the world. And we've seen that cycle in the past where really you go through a period where real goods, where real items, things that really exist, appreciate in value against assets like stocks, and we could be entering a period like that again. I mean, over the years, I remember way back when people would look at the price of equities versus wheat, or how many bushels of corn does it take to buy a Dow point, and things like that. And if you look over time, that's very cyclical. And so we could be entering a period where markets like soybeans, like corn, like cattle, like gold, like silver, and so forth will go through an appreciation against other asset classes.
Yeah. Well, you know, you never know, though, when those metrics change over time. I used to look at the old, like, 30s edition of securities analysis, and they priced the stock market in price to dividend. And unless that ratio is in an 80-year cycle, it hasn't really mattered for 80 years. So these things do, you know, come and go and fall out of favor, and it's always a question of how long the cyclicality will last, because sometimes things do change. I'm leaning towards you that I think this one will probably have another cycle, but I always worry that maybe things have changed. I mean, look at the importance placed on technology in the world today, and that really fits into that cycle. And so there is a narrative that can be put into the argument that this cycle won't repeat. And we do you innovate over time. It gets easier to pull things out of the ground. We're going to get better at growing corn probably as technology improves and whatnot. And so, you know, maybe it makes sense why corn is not at the same price it was in the 70s, because we've gotten so much better at producing corn than where we were in the 70s.
Well, you know, that brings up a really interesting point, because, and I'm going to switch over to another market, then I'll come back to corn.
Yeah.
As you hear people say, silver prices can't be where they're at because the cost of production is X. You hear that story all the time. To that, I say that's nonsense, because historically, raw material, silver's a raw material, corn's a raw material, end up getting priced at the cost of production of the most efficient producers, not the average producers, not the silver mine that's marginal, not the corn farmer that's marginal. It's the corn farmer that's the most efficient. It's the silver mine that's most efficient. It's that's how it works. And over time, of course, the efficiency in producing corn, you know, corn yields today are far, far higher than they were 40 years ago, 45 years ago when I started. It's a whole different world. The way people farm, it's a whole different world. The hybrids they grow, it's a whole different world. So, you know, to that extent, yeah. I mean, raw materials tend to slump back down to the cost of the most efficient producers. That's what's happening. But nevertheless, corn, you know, farmers will tell you, even efficient farmers, that they've been losing money on their corn. They've been making money on their dirt, but they've been losing money on their corn. And so, you know, maybe we'll go back through a period where farmers really start making money on their production itself.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go on to Bitcoin here, and we can come back to some commodities later. So we have the big, you know, it's a long-term chart for Bitcoin, less than 10 years. But the chart with all of the different parabolic advances on there, I see you have marked the current one we're in right now. You know, what are your views on Bitcoin? I'm sure everybody is interested here.
Yeah, what a crazy market. I almost pinch myself when to think that, you know, I'm still trading as an old guy, and I was privileged enough to have the first big major bull markets in grains and metals at the front end of my career. And now I get this crazy Bitcoin market, you know, as the bookend on the other end. How crazy is that? Here I'm in my mid 70s and I'm, you know, involved in a market like Bitcoin, which, by the way, is fascinating, because I was alerted to Bitcoin by Raoul Paul, who in 2016 sent me a chart of Bitcoin by email and said, "Peter, what do you think?" And at that point, you know, I'd heard people talking about Bitcoin. I didn't know what it was. I just thought, you know, it's just some computer money that's out there floating around. And so Raoul sent me this chart. And one look at this chart, I went, "Oh my goodness, is this just classically a beautiful chart?" And I didn't even know how to buy Bitcoin back then. Raul had to line me up with the exchange that he was using at the time. It's still the exchange that I opened an account with in March of 2016 at Raul's introduction. But, you know, the chart that you're looking at shows that we're in the third parabolic advance. And really, if you go back prior to that, you know, to the inception of Bitcoin through what you show as the first parabolic advance, there was another parabolic advance. So we're really in the fourth parabolic advance, which is amazing, because that chart is a log chart. It is hard to find a single parabolic advance on an arithmetic chart in most markets. And here we have parabolic advances on a log chart, and we have the fourth one. I mean, this is history. I mean, this does not happen in normal markets. And so, you know, right now, parabolic advances have tended to be pretty reliable in Bitcoin. It's a horse that's, you know, at least one placed or showed. And so it's a horse worth betting on. And, you know, you look at the Bitcoin chart, and from the December 2017 highs, back until September of last year, we formed this massive symmetrical triangle, what we call a symmetrical triangle or coil on the chart. And then we broke out of that last year, and then we kind of retested the upper boundary of that in August, September, and then we rolled back up. And of course, you know, as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're in a strong bull market in Bitcoin. I am fully long Bitcoin. As a matter of fact, it's my single largest holding within what I do. I own more stocks in value than Bitcoin, but I'm talking about individual stocks.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm fully committed to Bitcoin. I like Bitcoin. I think the burden of proof in Bitcoin is going to be on the bears. I mean, you look at social media and Bitcoin gets bashed and it gets trashed and it's going to zero and so forth. And you've got governments challenging Tether, which is a whole another story. But, you know, so you have people who go out there and create the narratives for Bitcoin to roll over and die. I think the burden of proof is on that. I mean, right now you have very strong ownership of Bitcoin. I mean, people have pointed out if every millionaire in the world owned one Bitcoin, there's not enough Bitcoins to go around. That's a true statement. And so, you know, the bet here, of course, for the bears that Bitcoin's just a big joke. It is this, you know, it's the beanie baby pet rock of the 2020s. You know, that remains to be seen. But the narrative for the bull is it's a true store of value. It's a true means for settling international global commerce, that it's the real thing, that it will some degree become a global currency, global reserve currency. That is the currency of the people, not the currency of a Fed. I mean, that's the bull narrative. And I think there's something to that bull narrative, quite frankly. Max, I think that there's something real to that, especially when I combine that, look at the history of the chart, look how chart construction's put together, and even watch the way that this market has rallied. This has been a unique, fun market to watch as it's gone up here, because it hasn't gone up on what people traditionally call FOMO. It's the fools rushing in and buying the strength. If you look at the ladder, the bid offer ladders of Bitcoin, it hasn't gone up by bids chasing the market. It's gone up every time somebody puts an offer out there on the table. It's just quietly consumed. And so it's gone up by buyers just taking offers off the table. That's the nature of the bull move. And when you see that, when I've seen that in all other markets, usually it's very constructive. Now, here's the caveat in Bitcoin, is when you look at the 2015 to 2017 bull market, we had 9 corrections of 30% or more. Actually, they averaged right around the mid-30s, you know, between 32 and 38, 39%. You know, this current bull market, when you take it from the March low of last year, we had that kind of washout, COVID washout low, and you take it from that point, we've had 2 corrections of 20% only and a few corrections of 10%. So we haven't had like the traditional 30% correction in Bitcoin. I'm not predicting it's going to happen, but it could happen. I mean, it would be certainly natural for it to happen. And so I think those who are not in Bitcoin and they're wondering, how do you get in Bitcoin? Well, you know, we recently had a 20% correction. Now, if we go down and we take out the recent lows, it's going to be more than a 20% correction. And so, you know, might we then approach a 30% correction? Could. And so, again, I think the burden of proof are on those people who want to claim that Bitcoin's a beanie baby pet rock. But I'll accept the narrative that there is hope that Bitcoin can become some form of global reserve currency, or at least a basket in a new world order combined with gold, crude oil, whatever, becomes a special drawing rights and in effect gets collateralized as a recognized currency. So, you know, for right now, I want to remain long. You know, a 20% correction didn't blow me out. I don't think a 30% correction is going to do much damage to me. And I think there's strong support underneath the market. You're starting to see commercial interest being willing to hold Bitcoin as an asset. When you start to see Fortune 500 companies list in their annual report a line item, and instead of cash equivalencies, they list cryptos, crypto will have arrived at that point. Once we get to that point, people who are declaring crypto to be dead meat will be proven wrong.
Okay. Well, I don't think we have time here to debate the narrative or the fundamentals, but I do have questions about trading parabolic advances. So we got a question from Barris who said about timing parabolic markets. Is there any way to time them, or at least, you know, how do you approach parabolic advances as a trader?
I mean, hey, it's like a rocket, right? You strap yourself into a rocket. It's not a calm ride. It's white knuckle. This is white knuckle flying. And the reality is that eventually you will break a dominant parabolic. You know, parabolics have the tendency to morph a little bit. You can draw a parabolic advance on the daily chart of Bitcoin, but there's a longer parabolic advance, which I think is the dominant parabolic advance on the weekly chart. That's the one that's going to hold. We're a long way from retesting that parabolic support, a long way. I mean, there you have a 40% correction to do that. And so, but the reality is, like in 2017, we knew what the parabola, we knew where it was drawn. And once you break a parabola, usually you get at least an 80% correction. The previous three parabolic advances in Bitcoin all corrected 80% plus. Eventually, we will correct 80% plus in this parabolic advance. Maybe it's from 150,000, I don't know, or 100,000, I don't know. But eventually, you will correct it. But in the meanwhile, you know, you don't use the parabola as your stop loss. I'll tell you that because, you know, by the time a parabolic advance is broken, usually you've already had a 40 to 50% correction. So you've given back half your money by the time you can say, wow, we're in trouble. And so, you know, a trader just has to be alert. Hey, I have no problem taking profits on the way up in a trade, putting, you know, cash in the market. I created an account to become involved in Bitcoin. I have taken profits so that I have completely covered my initial investment in Bitcoin. I'm playing with house money, and I'm willing to take a risk and give the market room on house money. I've reclaimed my investment. And, you know, if we get up to, let's say, 50,000, I will take a little bit more off. So I don't want to be chasing rallies here. You know, I want to be wise, have a base holding, which in my mind is about a third to a half of what I own now. And, you know, be willing to ride that back to zero.
Yep.
And so I think that's how one has to approach this is really it's a change in mentality. You know, here in the U.S., largely we have measured our wealth in U.S. dollars. You know, how much are you worth? You explain to somebody, it has a dollar sign on it. It is your base, right? You buy stocks, you return to your base. You buy real estate, you return to your base currency. Well, if the narrative is correct, Bitcoin becomes someone's base currency. So if, let's say in the case of X, Y generations who have made that mental change, that they're not going to measure their net worth in terms of dollars, that they've made a generational change, that Bitcoin is their currency. What do they care that Bitcoin goes down? You know, it doesn't matter that Bitcoin goes down. That's their base currency. That's their home currency. And so they're not worried about what Bitcoin is doing against the dollar because Bitcoin's their home currency. It's how they measure themselves. It's where they want their wealth. Where do you want your wealth? A farmer wants his wealth in land and dirt. They measure their value
acreage. Acreage, yeah. He's got a lot of acreage. Yeah.
A real estate guy measures his net worth by, you know, commercial buildings, number of floors, number of square feet.
Yeah, square feet.
Yeah. So why can't you measure your net worth in bitcoins? Periodically, you take a chance and you You know, you sell your Bitcoins against Ether, but then you come back to your base currency again, because it's how you measure yourself. And so I'm not there. At my age, I'm probably not going to make that leap. But I see the narrative. I see the mentality that somebody can have to be there.
All right. Well, I'm a different generation. I'm not quite there either. But I want to move on to gold. So we have a chart here of gold. It looks like it's gold futures, and you say in parentheses, you know, with the cost of rolls. So you're rolling the futures and taking that out here in price. Now, what are you seeing in gold? We had a big breakout earlier in 2020, and it has not been fun for gold bulls over the last few months.
Yeah, I mean, gold's gone higher, of course. I mean, you look at where it was in, you know, June, July of 2019, we've had a big run in gold. We've made new all-time highs in gold. Depends on how you measure the cost of the roll and so forth. But, you know, the trend's up. I'm not in gold right now, but my inclination is to want to be a gold buyer, to be a buyer. I want to be long gold. I don't want to be short gold. Now, you get into the whole subject of, is gold a store of value, gold versus Bitcoin? We can get into that whole debate. I'd rather not get into that debate. In my mind, gold is a commodity. You know, it's silver's a commodity, gold's a commodity, soybeans a commodity, copper's a commodity, lumber's a commodity. And so I don't look at gold as my home currency. Some people look at gold as their home currency.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, gold is how they measure everything. I'm not there. And I think history shows that you shouldn't be there. I mean, if you go back to the early 70s and measure it against the early 70s, the annualized rate of return of holding gold is probably negative. If you take out insurance and storage costs, it's negative. You haven't made any money. If you bury it in your backyard, maybe you can say you've annualized at 5% or 6%. Stock markets clean the clock on that one. Stocks have been a far better investment than gold. And of course, Bitcoin's been a better investment than gold, but we're only talking about a 10-year, you know, duration there. So I don't look at gold as this something special, precious. You call it a precious metal. For me, it's something that you get out of the ground. And if you go into the center of the earth, of this earth, there's more gold than anyone can own. And, you know, we're just scraping some of the gold that's come up through the cracks. And, you know, I think if somebody came here from another planet, intelligent being, they could not figure out why us human beings are going around thinking gold is something special. So, but nevertheless, the trend's up. When the trend's up, I basically want to look for opportunities to own it. And that's where I am in gold. We've had a good correction in gold. There'll be an opportunity at some point, I think in the next year, to own gold again and maybe pull out $300-$400 an ounce. So that's my attitude toward gold.
All right. Let's move on to oil. So we have oil futures here, and you can see that ridiculous move that we had when oil went negative. How does something like that screw up a chart? As a chartist, I got to ask, you know, how do you deal with a commodity going negative? Does it just completely, you know, do you have to erase it from the chart?
You just ignore it. I mean, I have people send me charts that have these big spindle spikes and say, where do I draw a line from that? And I go, it doesn't happen. It doesn't exist. I mean, we went to $45 on a fluke, and it had to do with oil, deliverable oil, and who could take it and who could deliver it. And it was a fluky deal. But even at $53, I mean, we may be as a world transitioning to renewables. And, you know, of course, there's a big run in stocks on solar and so forth. And it's been a hot space, you know, people saying, but here's the reality. I'm not prepared to get on a jet plane with 300 other people and fly to Europe on a jet plane that just got solar panels up on in windmills up on the top. Sorry, but I'll fly in planes that burn in jet fuel. And so, you know, we have a carbon-based energy system. Now, will we transition to more nuclear? Yes. Will we transition to solar? Yes. You look at, you know, you look at the crazy story going on with electric cars, Tesla, you know, unbelievable move in Tesla. You know, we've got countries that have now announced a timetable, California, on timetable for basically getting rid, phasing out of carbon-based automobile energy. And so, you know, we're going to see more of that, but there's still going to be a demand for energy. And here's the reality, as demand goes down, we're going to shut down marginal production at 53, 54, 55 gallons a barrel. If you look at history, crude oil's cheap. We've got cheap crude oil. We're cutting off production like crazy. You know, up at $80, $90, we're producing all kinds of crude oil from North Dakota. I mean, oil production in North Dakota, to think that the U.S. is a net exporting country of oil. Well, that can happen at a certain price, not at this price. And so you choke off supply. And, you know, I don't see the day, and perhaps tree huggers do, that there's not such a thing as burning carbon. But I think in my lifetime, and certainly yours, and certainly the lifetime of anybody who's alive right now, you know, carbon-based fuels are going to be a reality for certain uses. And so I think crude oil is cheap. I'm not long crude oil. I miss buying crude at minus 45. I couldn't have anyway, but or at 30. But I think we'll see $70 crude before we see $25 or $30 crude again.
Okay. All right. Well, we will get into Tesla a little bit. But before we do that, let's talk about interest rates and euro dollar futures that you have here.
Yeah. I mean, I think the chart of, and keep in mind, that's not euro currency, right? This is, euro dollars are the interest rates of dollars that are being held offshore. They're dollars that are sitting in Europe. I mean, that's where we get it. Euro, it's euro dollars. It's dollars in Europe. And what's the interest rate? And it's really the equivalent of treasury bills, right? Yeah. We get treasury bill interest here. You get euro dollar interest, euro LIBOR interest in Europe and elsewhere. And so that's what that is. But if you look at that chart, basically, you can see that, you know, we've gone to U.S. interest rates measured by euro dollars of zero. We went to the world of ZERP, zero interest rate policy here in the U.S. That's where we took the short end of the yield curve here, 2-year notes, 5-year notes, just about zero. We're not much above that. So you have to look at history. We had higher interest rates in the world in the 1960s, in the 1900s, in the 1800s, in the 1700s. These interest rates, we're going to go through a cycle where we're not going to see these interest rates again, at least in anybody's generation who's alive today. You know, it's crazy. You look at interest rates in Switzerland, minus 70 basis points, minus 0.7%. You want to own money. You want to hold money in Swiss francs? You pay the government for the privilege to do that. Same thing in a lot of European countries. It's a negative interest rate. You have negative interest rate policies. And so, you know, we've scraped the top. We're not in the U.S. going to go into negative interest rate policies. Or if we do, it's going to be a fluke. We're going to go to higher interest rates. I don't want to get into the inflation story. I just want to get into the fact that I don't think there's anything unhealthy about going into higher interest rates. I mean, I purchased a home back in 1983 at a 14% mortgage rate. And I didn't think anything of it at the time. I mean, I had money in T-bills that was earning 17%. And so, I mean, that was unusual. That was the high in the yields. I mean, that was the high in the cycle. So I just think that my mind right now is basically the game to lower rates is done. I mean, that's over. We've had that trend. It started in the early 1980s. It was a 40-year trend to zero interest rates in the U.S. That's done. We have to look forward. We're going to have a trend to higher rates. Now, we'll probably get there two step forwards, one step back. It's not going to be a huge surge, but we're going to get there. You know, my advice to young people who are can get these kind of mortgage rates right now is buy the most expensive home you can possibly afford. Take as much money out as you can possibly pay back, and you'll be well served over time.
Okay. All right. Well, I do want to let the audience know we got some questions that I just want to save to the end. Peter, can you do a little bit overtime today? Go a little longer than the hour?
Yeah, we will. Always for Real Vision. You know that.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Peter. I do want to get through all these charts, though. So we have here the long-term chart of the S&P 500. And man, you cannot even see what happened in March of 2020 on this chart.
No, I mean, I think that's a log chart. I think I give you a log chart, not a linear chart. So, yeah. The trend has been up. I mean, you know, again, you go to Peter Schiff and say, tell me how gold has been such this great investment over stock. Doesn't exist. I mean, stocks have been the place to be. Common stocks have been a fabulous investment for U.S. investors. Unfortunately, we have a lot of people in the U.S. who do not own common stocks. They may, of course, have retirement funds and pension funds and so forth, but it's been a great place to be. You know, we have these perma bears out there. All I want to do is talk about the top of the stock market. And, you know, hey, I can create a story with charts that does suggest that maybe we could be approaching this top. I mean, we're in a lofty territory here. You know, we're into some high territory here, you know, and you can argue based on traditional valuations, you know, price versus PE, price versus sale, price versus national debt. And you can create all of these global macro arguments that say the stock market shouldn't be at the current level, at the level it's at. But the reality is we are at the level that we are at, and common stocks have been a fabulous investment. You know, of course, not all categories of stocks. You know, you look for a number of years, it was tech stocks. It was a tech show. Here more recently, we've seen small cap stocks be on a tear. We've seen different category of stocks. We see alternative energy. We've seen, you know, of course, during COVID, things like Zoom, you know, ways to pay bills online, that sort of thing. We see that, but that's been the history of the stock market. You have a hot category, it cools off. Hot category, it cools off. The important thing is there's been rotation. And so we've seen rotation, you know, to a new thing that'll kind of be the lifeboat and carry the market until it solidifies. So I don't want to bet against the U.S. stock market. You know, here's the problem with that. And we talked about that a little bit in Bitcoin, is when you say that you want, a person says they want, they're super bearish the stock market. What they're really saying is they're super bulls in the dollar. Because you get out of the stock market, guess where your money goes? Goes into U.S. dollars. And so the stock market is a bet against the dollar. U.S. stocks are valued in an expression of U.S. dollars. And so anytime you buy stocks, you go short the dollars. Long stock, short dollars. You go short stocks, you're long dollars. Your best long dollars. And so, you know, there's two sides to this trade, and people have to remember that. For the time being, maybe there's a point at which there's a top of the stock market. I don't see it yet. Yes, it's stretched out. Yes, wants to be cautious. I'm about 55, 60% committed now in retirement money to U.S. common stocks. And so that's where I'm at now. If someone wants to take the chart that they're seeing and create a bearish story about it, what you do is you say, we have a big broadening top. You know, big broadening top, you have a high, you have a low, you have a high, you have the low. One of the lows is the March 2019 low. And so you can create that. You can go back to Richard W. Schaubacher, 1934, technical analysis and stock market profits. You can go to 1948. John McGee, Robert Edwards, technical analysis and stock market trends. You can read all about broadening patterns. It is a classical pattern. It's a classical chart pattern. It's recognized by classical chartists as the real deal, as a real recognized pattern. And so we have that right now in the stock market. One could say, if stocks collapse from here, and let's say we have a 50% correction in stocks, you know, you're going to be able to look at the chart and say we topped with a broadening top. But a top's not a top until it's completed. You cannot declare a chart pattern to be a chart pattern until it's a chart pattern. Until it's a chart pattern with completion, it's only a possible chart pattern. And so you can't be bearish based on a broadening top because we don't have a broadening top yet. We have a possible broadening top. And so, you know, I don't want to predict markets. I want to respond to markets. I don't want to be a predictor. I don't want to take a chart and start drawing all kinds of fancy lines on the path that I see a market taking. I think that's a fool's game, quite frankly. You know, I want to know where a market is. I don't want to know where it's vulnerable. I want to know if I want to take the other side of my position. I want to know what that argument is from a classical charting point of view. For me, the argument is not PE ratios. It's not price to sales. It's not all of that kind of stuff. Although I'm not saying those things are illegitimate. I mean, you work for a guy who's brilliant in looking at markets, Raul. He has all my respect in the world. He and I may differ on how we view markets. We may differ 180 degrees.
Yeah.
But I respect that he comes to conclusions based on common sense and procedure. So if I were to say I'm going to become a stock market bear and start drawing lines into the future, I'd draw it based on the broadening top. It's not a broadening top yet. And so I'll be looking now. Quite frankly, based on instinct, and I got to tell you, my instincts are not the best. I mean, my strong convictions in a trade are not necessarily positively correlated with outcome. But my hunch is that we're going to see a big, broad trading range in U.S. equities in 2021. We had the big rip up from the March lows, you know, especially when you look at NASDAQ, but even S&Ps, even Dow. You know, we've had the big run up. You know, is that sustainable? Is that sustainable as we transition to a new government? I kind of don't think so. You know, we're going to see tax law changes. We're going to see uncertainty of a new government. I think that, you know, those are fundamentals. Now, I trade on charts. I don't trade on them. So what I'm telling you is what I think could be the environment of the stock market in the coming year. And so kind of in the back of my crawl space here, I'm thinking, don't be a dogmatic bull in the U.S. stock market. Be cautious. That doesn't mean I am not long stocks like Micron, Johnson & Johnson, IBB, an ETF on healthcare. I'm going to be long things like that. Cigna Insurance, looking to be long. I'm going to look at those opportunities. But in terms of the general market, I guess I'm kind of preparing to see a two.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Way market.
Okay. Now, what about some of these rotations that have worked, the things that have been the lifeboats? You talked about solar and renewable energy as being a narrative that the market is clinging to, as well Tesla, a subset of that narrative, but perhaps a beast of its own to even be separated again as its own narrative all in itself. You know, those have seen miniature parabolic advances this year. Now, when you look at this chart of Tesla, and we'll take a look at TAN, the solar ETF, in just a second. You know, what are you seeing? And as a chartist, you know, how do you trade that?
Luckily, I'm a chartist, and so you know I trade patterns. You know, I trade setups. I'm a setup trader, And that's how I treat it. And luckily, in the case of Tesla, I cannot claim that, oh, I saw the story. I own Tesla. I mean, I've seen YouTube videos that are fabulous. I know of people, younger people, that bought Tesla automobiles, absolutely believed in it, and put their life savings in Tesla stock 4 or 5 years ago and are now millionaires. Yet, you know, retired from working. Kudos. Congratulations. Yeah, I bow to you. That's brilliant. I love the story. I think those are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful stories. And but you know, I'm in and out. I'm a swing trader. And there luckily have been some really, really, really nice patterns in Tesla on the way up. There's been a couple.
I can see those little pullbacks on the way up.
Yeah, there have been. There's been some nice places where a person's been, you know, I've been able to take out $200-$300 here, and then you get a split and, you know, you kind of start over again. You know, I haven't ridden the whole thing up, but, you know, I kind of compare myself as a trader to American football. I know people from Europe aren't going to get this because they don't think American football is really football because you use your hands. But the reality is I play football. My trading would be compared to playing football between the 30-yard lines. That's where I want to play my game. You know, not end zone to end zone. I don't want to run back 105-yard touchdowns. That's what's happened in Tesla. It's been 120-yard touchdown. Back of the end zone to the back of the end zone. But they even extended the field, and the runner ran out of the stadium. But, you know, I'll take 30 yards in the cloud of dust. And so that's how I'll continue to trade it. But there's been a lot of naysayers. Elon Musk has had a lot of naysayers, and he's going to continue to have a lot of naysayers. But my contention from the very beginning was something somebody told me 4 or 5 years ago when they said, buy a Tesla and you won't be bearish the stock. And I heard that. And I had more than one person tell me it's tough to own a Tesla car and be super bearish the stock. And the little things like that, you hear from people, you go, that means something. And I think that's what's happened. And, you know, people have looked at Tesla and said, oh, my goodness, how can the valuation of this car company, electric car company, be equal to the entire valuation of every other car company in the world? I've got a cuckoo clock going on. That's my ode to Germany. So in any case, I think the story is Tesla hasn't been, I'll wait for cuckoo to be done. Tesla has not been a story of an electric car company. Tesla has been a story of energy, alternative energy, a whole way, new way to think about things. It's ushering in. It's kind of, you can say the same thing about Apple, you know, 7, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, you know, this price is overvalued for a stupid telephone, little thing you carry around that you talk on. It's overvalued. Well, good luck on that one. And so to a certain degree, you have the same thing. It's a legend. You have legendary stock. You know, Walmart, McDonald's, Microsoft, Apple, Tesla. You have stocks like that. Goldman Sachs, they're legendary stocks. Tesla's joined that list. It's a legendary stock. Now, that doesn't mean to say that we may not have correction, but Tesla is just not an investment. You can't look at it and say, yeah, but they only sold so many cars this year.
Well, until the rest of the market starts saying that, until the narrative that has been driving it has been violated. You know, there are some charts, though, like in Europe, the most mature electric vehicle market as a percentage of the cars that are sold. If you look at that as a symbol of what we can expect for the rest of the world, Tesla is no longer the dominant car being sold, and people are noticing. Yep. And that hasn't mattered to the market yet, but as it starts to matter to people, and as people start to buy other electric vehicles, it could change. But it's really the narrative changing and the market appreciating that narrative that is when it's going to play out in price. And as of right now, that's not a narrative that anybody really cares about. And so until that has been violated, it sounds like you're going to be buying dips.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to be buying, definitely be buying setups. Mm-hmm. I mean, do I think Tesla's overvalued? I think it's crazy. I think the evaluation of Tesla is absolutely insane, to tell you the truth. I mean, that's my personal opinion. Would I short Tesla if I see a classical chart pattern? No way. No way. Will I buy Tesla if I get a buy setup in a second?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to the TAN ETF, which encompasses some of this narrative that you're talking about. But it has had quite a run itself. You know, I see it down well below, was it down 20, something like that in March, and up well over 100 at this point. You've made more money buying TAN at the bottom, maybe, than you made buying Bitcoin.
Yeah, you know, well, no, that's not the case. But nevertheless, we've seen a play on, you know, alternative energy. I mean, that's been a big play. You know, of course, the story there is we're going to have a new administration. It's an administration that wants to hug trees and outlaw carbon. And, you know, we're going to see a play in any form of alternative energy. And that's what's happened. And I think, quite frankly, it's probably overpriced itself compared to what's going to become reality. You know, we can talk big about, you know, where all the energy space is going, but it's been a good play. And we've seen other, I mean, it's not the only one. We've seen a number of other similar stories like that. And so, you know, solar, alternative energy, electric cars, all of that sort of thing. So that's what's going on. And, I'll be alert for those. If I see patterns, I'm not a big bull on solar. I mean, I'm not a big bull on solar. I'm not planning to put solar in my house. I'll probably buy a Tesla. But we're going to continue to see, and people need to be alert for setups like that can offer great swing trades.
Okay. What about uranium? It's not in a sort of major breakout, at least on the long-term chart, as compared to, say, Tesla or TAN. And it's really the redheaded stepchild of the green energy trend. I'm interested to hear, you know, what you have to say about it as somebody who is a chartist.
Well, I mean, I'm going to speak as a global citizen. I think it's crazy that the United States has missed out on this. There's, nuclear power is clean. Yeah, it's had safe, but the technology today for nuclear power plants is not the technology that we've seen give us problems in the past. Is there always risk with nuclear power? Of course there is. But I think that the reality is it's a clean source of energy. It doesn't pollute the atmosphere. And so I think, will there be sanity by the U.S. to re-embrace nuclear power? I certainly hope so. Of course, Europe did, and Europe's kind of drifting actually away from it now. But China's embraced nuclear power. And the problem is American technology was left in the dust, because nuclear power became the hated stepchild of the United States political powers that be, as well as the environmental industry. You know, even the environmental industry that's crying for clean power hated nuclear energy by and large. And so I think that we will see a turnabout here at some point in time. I hope so. I think nuclear power is a common sense way to go. I think that technology is there for safe nuclear power. And if there is a trend back to nuclear power, certainly uranium will be a good investment. There, fortunately, are some uranium futures. They're not the most liquid in the world, but they're tradable. And of course, we've seen a lot of these rare minerals. We've seen some rare minerals ETFs that have done extremely well. And so, I mean, I think that's a place to continue to look. Is nuclear, it's had a run. I'm not prepared to actually even be long in that space right now. But I think it's a space I kind of have my eye out there on the edge and say, you know, I'm going to be aware of opportunities that come from that part of the world.
Okay. One final chart that you brought with you today that I would like to get to is the BDRY BreakWave Shipping ETF. So it looks to me, based on what I see from the chart, that you probably are bullish on shipping. And then I want to get into some questions. We got some great questions just about trading.
Hey, COVID created disaster to global commerce. I mean, that's the reality. It shut things down. All of a sudden the ports are filled with chips and ships and the ocean's empty. And so, we will return to normal. I'm shocked that we are where we're at right now, but that's a whole nother debate, how the world's responded to COVID. But, shipping companies, the shipping industry stock got clobbered because the bottom fell out, so to speak, from the shipping industry. So I think that'll come back. And so I think it's a space that I have some ownership of. It's a space that I'm interested in. I'm hearing from people who are in that industry. And I hate saying, oh, somebody in the industry told me to be long, so I'm going to be long. I mean, I don't do that. That's not me. But when seeing people that I consider to be intelligent, informed, tell me that they think their industry is poised for a good run, I'm certainly going to look at the charts and say, what can I find that support what they're saying that makes sense to me, that give me the trade that I want with the risk management I want? So that's where I see that right now.
Okay. Well, Peter, thank you so much for running through all these different assets, and your reputation precedes you. So we did get some questions about how to trade charts. And John wants to know, in your experience, how successful are patterns, especially those with horizontal boundaries like head and shoulders, right angled triangles, on lower timeframes like hourly charts compared with longer term charts like weekly and daily?
Not reliable. Here's the reality, is that charts morph. You know, you see something that you think, okay, this is what I'm looking at, and it has a way of becoming something different. And the reality is that 1 minute charts morph more often than 5 minute charts, more often than 10 minute charts, more often than 1 hour charts, more often than 2 hour charts, more often than 6 hour charts, more often than daily charts, more often than weekly charts. And so there's two parts to this answer. One is you just have a lot more unreliability as you go down the time scale. Does that mean there are not trades that take place on the lower time scale? Of course, that doesn't mean that. There certainly will be times when you see a pattern on an hourly chart and the pattern works. More often than not, you can say, especially if that pattern occurs in a trend and you think it's going to reverse that trend on a lower time frame, more often than not, it's going to morph and it's going to resolve itself in the direction of the dominant trend in that time frame. And so I caution people against that, but that really raises a whole big philosophical question. And that is, do chart patterns predict? Are chart patterns an accurate, a reliable way to forecast price? To that, I would say absolutely not. They're overrated. That chart patterns in and of themselves do not provide a big edge to a trader. I'm sorry, they don't. Now, I've made money trading charts for 45 years. So I'm telling you that as somebody who has been profitable by trading chart construction for 45 years, chart patterns do not provide a significant edge in and of themselves. But I have to use something to determine when I'm going to buy and sell. I have to have some way to say I'm going to be long or I'm going to be short, I'm going to be in or I'm going to be out. Chart patterns provide for me a couple of things. They give me what I think is, they show me what I think is the path of least resistance. They show me levels where there has been support. And it'll suggest the opportunities where I might have an asymmetrical reward to risk trade. It's in that trade management where the edge has gotten. It's in risk management. It's in trade management. It's not in direction. It's more in timing. Because for a trade to be a good trade, it has to be right directionally and it has to be right tactically. And if it's wrong on either one of those, it's a wrong trade. And so that's what chart patterns are for me. It's just a way for me to pull the trigger and know where I'm wrong.
Okay. We got a question. As a trader, how do you deal mentally with losing trades and missed opportunities? How do you stay centered and focused and moving on to the next trade?
Hey, my job as a trader, my mentor going back to the Board of Trade said, your job as a trader is to take losses. It's your primary occupation. You are in the business of taking losses because that's primarily what you're going to do. And my mental default position is my next trade is going to be a loser. That's the way I think. I have no problem. Losing trades don't really affect me. They're part of the territory. I mean, I believe strongly that trading, at least my type of trading, is ruled by Vilfredo Pareto, an Italian philosopher and economist. And that is that, you know, it's the old 80-20 rule. 20% of your trades attribute 80% of your profits. I think for me, I know my numbers year by year by year. I know my Pareto level. And so it's not really 80-20 for me. It's more like 90-10 or 85-15. What that means is out of 100 trades, 15% of those trades will produce my net bottom line in a year. That's been true for me year in, year out, year in, year out. Very stable. 15% of my trades produce 85% of my profits. Some years it's 10. Some years it's over 100. You know, 10% of my trades produce 100% of my profits. And so, but that's the reality. And so part of my job is to work my way through the losers to find the Pareto trades. I need a Pareto trade. I need to have 15% of my trades produce my profit. If I can't find those, then I'm in big trouble. But so losing trades are losing trades. They come with the territory. You know, it's just what comes. Now, when I say a losing trade, not necessarily a losing trade, it could be a small winner, it could be something I have a profit and come back and get out at break even. It could be I end up taking my initial loss that I expected the loss in the day or two of the trade. But my job is to take losses, you know, cut my losses short and hopefully let my winners become Pareto trades. As long as they're winners, give them an opportunity to fulfill the predictions of Vilfredo Pareto. And so losses are losses. Losses come with the territory. Hey, the markets, and I'm speaking to your audience, the markets don't know you people. They don't know where you live. They don't know the color of your hair. They don't know your personality. They don't take you personal. They don't know you exist. So why do you take a loss personally? It's not a personality defect. It's not a character fault. It's a loss, people. Losses happen. A lot of losses happen because you got to work your way through a lot of losses to find the trades that really are going to matter.
Okay.
That's my answer to that one.
That is a wonderful place to leave it. Peter, thank you so much for taking the time today, for running through all those charts and for giving us a little picture into how you have traded for the last 40 years.
Thank you very much, Mason. Always a pleasure to be with you guys.
All right. Until next time.
Yep.